Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Melissa in the Morning takes a look at what the fall will bring. We're back in session now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
So we've been talking about teacher shortages, and in recent weeks, as we were getting closer and closer to the start of the new school year, we talked about application processes a little bit, and unfortunately, in some big news last week, the hiring processes that go on at schools across Connecticut. So I thought this would be a really great opportunity to do a deeper dive into the teacher situation and also look at hiring processes and application processes to become a teacher or come out of retirement and go back to teaching. So for that, I have, of course, Executive Director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents, Fran Rabinowitz, back on the show. Who else would I speak to? Fran is like my go-to person. Good morning, Fran. Thank you for coming back on. How are you?
I'm very well, Melissa, and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Fran, we are into the 2022-23 school year. Hard to imagine, but here we are. Everybody is back to school at this point. Where are we at? Since the last time you and I spoke, we were seeing several districts across Connecticut at severe teacher shortage numbers.
Well, I think we are still seeing many, many shortages in the profession, Melissa. I was with a whole group of superintendents yesterday who were telling me they had a wonderfully positive opening, but they're still very concerned about some shortages that they have in their districts. And frankly, it matters which district you're in. I mean, some of the suburban districts are short one or two special ed teachers, which is a hardship. But in a Hartford, a Bridgeport, a New Haven, they're absolutely short, 70, 90 positions, which is incredibly difficult to provide the same quality education that we want to provide.
So it came to my attention, Fran, actually, I have a family member who's a teacher in Bridgeport, and before the school year, she had gone back, obviously, for that week where teachers get back, they get themselves all situated and all that. She had told me that they're in a situation in Bridgeport where say she's got a classroom of 25 kids, let's just say. She's a solo teacher, by the way, no assistant teacher. They're getting rid of caps, according to her. They're getting rid of caps, at least in the meantime, where you could have however many kids they've got to stick in your room, they're going to stick in your room. So that could be 30 kids, 35, 40, I don't know. And at some point later this fall, if this person wants to go back and say, hey, this is way too much for me to handle, they can remove those kids and put them in another classroom, maybe even another school. I had never heard of this before, but it just sounds like a disaster, not just for the teachers that they've got to handle this, but for the kids who eventually get accustomed to what they're doing. Like, 5-6-year-olds, I'm thinking in kindergarten, this is a huge adjustment year for them, and they potentially could get moved because it's overwhelming the teacher.
Well, frankly, a couple of things. Number one, I haven't heard about that. It doesn't mean it's not happening, but I haven't heard it. I think it is incredibly detrimental. I know that we're stuck, and I would prefer to see a substitute come in. I have fought my entire career for lower class size, especially in the early grades. That it's unacceptable to put 35 or 40 kids in a classroom. Also, I remember times when I was on, just did not know how to handle a situation where there were more kids signed up for a school than I had room for. Mm-hmm. And we did everything in our power not to move those children, because you're right. I mean, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, fifth grade, they have an affiliation to that school, and it is very difficult to move them after they begin school. So you have to try every possible way of not making that happen.
Fran Rabinowitz is here, the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. And we've been talking to Fran, I don't know, for the last year, 2 years, we've been talking about teacher shortages. This has been an issue, though, for quite some time. I know you and I had talked about, for example, like special education. That's probably one of the biggest shortages we are facing in Connecticut right now, and we have been. So, you know, I know some of the solutions are, like you said, substitutes. Another thing you and I have talked about is bringing people out of retirement. Now, it's interesting because I would love to hear from you before I tell you what this listener has said to me. And again, this is why we have these conversations, folks, is if you hear something or something has happened, I can talk to the experts about it. What is the process? Say I'm a retired teacher. I taught for 20 years. I was a great teacher. I was never a teacher. But say I am, and I want to come out of retirement to help out with the teacher shortages. What does that process look like, Fran Rabinowitz?
Well, number one, if I wanted to come out of retirement and teach tomorrow, in just about every case, if I've been a very proficient teacher, the districts would definitely want me back. And I would say to you, number one, if you're going back to a district where you retired from, I would call the human resource department and, you know, and say, hey, I'm interested in coming back. And I would, you know, come back as a full-fledged teacher, not as a substitute. And if it's in another district, I would apply, you know, through REAP Connecticut or whatever, and I would apply for that position as a regular teacher.
So that was a question that I'll follow up with, and I think I had kind of mentioned this to you. I had someone who was a retired music teacher for, I think, 30 years, is my understanding.
Yep.
And he said his experience is that he had to do what's called an Ed TPA. Now, I have no idea what that means. I don't know what an Ed TPA is. But it sounds like it was some kind of, like, application almost process to be like, hey, this is what I used to do. This is what I'd like to go back to doing. I'm going to come out of retirement. I don't know what it is. Do you know what that is? Could you tell me what that is?
I do know Ed TPA.
Okay.
And Ed TPA is at the end of pre-service. It's the Education Teacher Performance Assessment. It's a huge deal, and it's usually given, you know, during student teaching. It's a performance assessment. I personally have never heard of someone coming back into teaching that had to take that. Now, perhaps the person let his certification lapse. That may be a case where something like that might take place, but I honestly haven't heard about it.
Interesting.
But, you know, I do know Ed TPA.
Okay. All right. We are back in session, and we are talking to Fran Rabinowitz, the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. So, Fran, we were talking about just the application process if you wanted to come out of retirement. And my understanding is unless your license lapsed, you don't have to go through this crazy long process if you wanted to come out of retirement or pay a bunch of fees to come out of retirement. Okay. I wanted to clarify.
Absolutely not. Unless your certification lapsed, that's a whole different ballgame. But if it hasn't lapsed, you are free to apply. And actually, we'd be very thrilled to have you.
Okay. So that's good to know. And then another thing, Fran, is hiring processes. And I'm not going to dive into a lot of this. I know a lot of it is still speculation. A lot of it is under investigation. I know we have heard, obviously, from Greenwich. But after what happened last week with the assistant principal, obviously a lot of families around Connecticut are now in question of how are hiring processes done in Connecticut. And I just figured you, if anybody, could kind of speak to, is this common practice in Connecticut? Or what are sort of the standards for hiring teachers in districts? Now, I know with Greenwich, they've got a little more money than most other districts do. But what is sort of the standard to give people peace of mind?
So let me just say that the most important piece of an administrator's job is the hiring process, okay? Whether you're a superintendent, a principal, et cetera, it is incredibly important. So let me tell you the ideal way to hire, and I would say it's not difficult, but it is important. number one, you have a committee to hire. You never hire in a vacuum. And I have not seen that as common practice. The committee is common practice. And I always encouraged the principal, if there was an assistant principal, to be on the committee, the teacher from the grade level, another teacher, a parent, and you would have a slew of candidates, right, depending upon the position. And if it was at the high school, the department head, whatever. And those slew of candidates would come through. You have rating sheets on each candidate. You ask each candidate the same question, and you rate it. Then the committee meets as a whole and decides who their finalists are. And those finalists, and we usually ask for two or three, they're passed on to the assistant superintendent and the superintendent. And they then follow up with another interview and choose the finalists. That is the process that I know, that I was taught, and that I believe exists across the state.
So when you were in Bridgeport or even in Hamden, that was sort of the process you went, was with a committee. I mean, you're talking about five or six people. Even if you have 30 people applying for a job, that was the process they went through.
That was definitely the process that we went through. And because in Bridgeport, I could not, because of 38 schools and hiring over 200 people a year, I could not always interview at the teacher level, but people from central office did interview and decide who would be coming from that committee. You know, when the finalists came forward, there was a second interview. But it was, I just want to stress, it was always a committee, because who wants to make that decision on their own in a vacuum? You want different perspectives to say who would be best for a biology position or a first grade position.
Well, and what I find interesting as well is, and granted, you know, again, all under speculation at this point, so I won't dive too much into it, but when you're dealing with a teacher shortage in general right now, especially, I do find it very suspect that any school district, no matter how much money you could throw at your teachers, you're willing to miss out on somebody who brings quality, even if they don't align with your thoughts and opinions on things. I find that very interesting. I'll leave it that way.
Yeah, I mean, personally, Melissa, I can't speak to every situation, obviously, but I always wanted people with different perspectives, even in my leadership team, mm-hmm. because I just think you arrive at better decisions and you operate better if you have a number of perspectives around you. And I always felt that way, for better or worse, and I'm thinking that I'm hopeful that that's the way others feel. I don't know everything, and no one person knows everything. So you need to have broad and wonderful perspectives and arrive at a decision that is far richer and stronger.
Well, that's why you're the best friend, at least in my opinion. That's why you're a great educator. You're the best, in my opinion, and you're the best on WICC. And I really appreciate you talking about all of these topics and, of course, keeping us in the loop with what's going on at the school level, at the state level. And I'm sure we'll be talking again very soon. But thank you for now, Fran, for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for having me. Take care.
Always, always. Fran Rabinowitz, the Executive Director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents here on WICC. Last week, we were talking about Opioid Overdose Awareness Day, which was signed into a proclamation by the governor, actually. But it's something that was recognized all throughout Connecticut and even throughout the country. And there were different walks. There were different events that were held in order to bring awareness to something that has become, unfortunately, very common, especially among young people here in Connecticut. And I got connected to an incredible woman who started to tell me her story ahead of an event she was holding last week to bring awareness again to opioid overdoses. Her name is Iris, Iris Seda, and Iris is here right now to share her story, why she cares so much about this and what she has done after going through a very personal tragedy of her own. Iris, good morning. Thank you so much for being here on the show.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Thank you so much. And I, again, really appreciate you being brave, coming on the show and sharing what you and your loved ones have gone through, Iris. It sounds like you lost your daughter to an overdose.
I did. I lost my daughter, Ana Caridad Sepulveda, to a drug overdose. Anna was way on her way to her recovery. She was actually working on her schooling and her recovery. She had just finished EKG, a whole PCT with a 4.0 GPA.
Wow.
And she was well on her way to her recovery, and I was very proud of her. It only took, unfortunately, one relapse. And that relapse, she actually got hit by a car, unfortunately, and she became addicted to medical opiates.
Mm.
And went out there to purchase something that she thought was a Percocet. And unfortunately, it was a fentanyl stress pill. And that is one of the main issues that we are encountering right now in our community, and it is the lacing and the tainting of many, many substances with this fentanyl.
Yeah, we talk about fentanyl, unfortunately, a lot in the news. I wish I didn't have to, but it's something that I think ever since I stepped on the scene as a news reporter over 10 years ago, fentanyl has been a problem. And unfortunately, too, Iris, which I'm sure, you know, maybe you can speak to this. People don't think fentanyl has really been on the scene until really only a couple of years ago. And really, fentanyl has been a problem for 15, 20 years, maybe even longer than that. It's just that it's coming over in waves now where it's uncontrollable. Like Pandora's box is wide open and fentanyl's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Definitely. It is definitely a paradigm. We encounter many, many different trends when it comes to drug use. And even though this fentanyl problem is a situation that has been, you know, overwhelming our communities for the past 10 to 15 years, they have just recently become far more acute. And that contribute to the tainting and the lacing of many, many substances. Imagine your child going to try marijuana for the first time. And your child encounters a batch that is poisoned with fentanyl, and he dies on his very first experimentation.
Mm.
So it is definitely an acute issue. Right now it is a paradigm. It is a trend that is taking over. And that's why a lot of people tend to see it as a new issue rather than an existing problem that we have been dealing with for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking this morning to Iris Seda, and Iris lost her daughter. How old was Anna when she died?
I was 22. The day before Thanksgiving last year,
I'm so sorry. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you so much, my dear. I received a phone call that no parent wants to receive.
Yeah.
I woke up that morning. I went to get my matcha the way I usually do. When I came back, my kids were running downstairs telling me, Anna's dead, Anna's dead. I just couldn't believe it. I just could not believe that my 22-year-old, who was very well on her recovery, had just passed as a result of a relapse.
Mm.
You know,
yeah, which is very common. It's very common.
Yeah.
And something else that you talked about, which I know that's why there have been major lawsuits, is when you get hurt and you get put on these very addictive opioids to overcome it, and they become, you know, very addictive, unfortunately. And people who never had addictive personalities or, you know, even abused alcohol struggle to try to wean off of these drugs. They're very, very powerful. So you touch on a lot of different things. And Iris, I know you have sort of an organization. You have a group that you've created called COPE. Tell us about COPE.
Yes. COPE stands for Caridad, which is my daughter's middle name, Caridad's Opioid Preventable Epidemic. We have become a hub to the community where we link the members of the community to existing services, to existing agencies, as well as to our politicians. So we basically have become a hub, a link between existing services and our community via referral, via events, you know, bringing awareness to the community, creating rallies. I personally think information and education are extremely important at this point. Mm-hmm. If I would have known then what I know now, I was always a proactive and criticized mom that had condoms and dental dams on top of the table available for my kids. But mm-hmm. these are the signs of the times. Now, you know, I have condoms, dental dams, and even Narcan kits. You know, right. I want my kids to be prepared. I want my kids to be prepared for anything they encounter. And if we are preventing STDs, why not prevent overdoses as well? Harm reduction works. We just need to know that we got to meet the addict where they are until they're ready to join the recovery aspect, if they ever do. My daughter was in recovery. She did have an addictive personality. She was, like I said, well on her recovery. She was being on treatment, and one relapse, that's all it took. And unfortunately, she also lost her godbrother to another relapse. Mm-hmm. So I have joined and I have merged with many, many parents. And right now, what we all agree upon is that if we knew then what we know now, so we want to bring that to the community. We want to bring that to the parents. We want to bring that to the sisters, the mothers, the teachers, anybody that is willing to absorb this knowledge, because mm-hmm. it is indeed practical, and it is life-saving.
Yeah, it really is. And they have a full Facebook group if anybody is interested. It's called COPE, Caridad's Opioid Preventable Epidemic, and you could find it on Facebook. Do you guys have a website or anything else, anywhere else you want people to direct their attention?
Yes, definitely. They can join us at copeofbridgeport.com. That is our website. They can join us in there. They can follow our events. I'm much more proactive on Facebook and Instagram. So if anybody wants to follow us, there is COPE.
Iris, God bless you. Thank you for sharing your daughter's story, and thank you for keeping her alive through the work that you're doing to help other parents out here in Connecticut. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you having me and giving me the opportunity to basically not just share my testimony, but to, you know, teach a little and raise hope, because right now we need to know that there's hope out there, that there is help, that there are ways in which we can engage this epidemic and make a dent on it. We won't be able to stop it, obviously, but we can definitely deal with it in a proactive manner in which we can be effective dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Iris Seda, thank you so much again, and I look forward to talking to you again really soon.
Thank you, and have a great day, and once again, thank you for having me.
No problem.
It's time to get out and explore. Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
So apparently there's a machine making oxygen on Mars, paving the way for human exploration. I mean, every week this guy just blows my mind. David Mestre of Science You May Not Know, good morning, friend.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued. I would like to learn more. I want to know what the heck you're talking about.
Yeah, super. Yeah. Well, you know, we are thinking of going to Mars, but to live on Mars, we've got one big problem. We can't breathe.
Can't breathe. So we really can't live on Mars.
We can't really live on Mars.
There's like this teeny tiny issue with the whole
just,
living
just
on Mars
problem,
thing.
Problem, you know, technical issue that we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah.
So one of the things that happens is that, you know, living on Earth, you know, we have oxygen all around us, and we're oxyphiles. You know, we're an animal that actually breathes and lives on oxygen. And on Earth, you know, where does all this oxygen come from? Well, we got two big sources. We got plankton in the ocean that produces oxygen, and we got trees and plants. They produce oxygen, but none of those things are actually on Mars. And so if we're going to live on Mars, we're going to need to get the oxygen from somewhere. Now, what we could do is we can bring the oxygen with us, but that's expensive, and we'd have to bring a bunch of oxygen, really
like
a whole lot of oxygen.
Yeah.
And so, one of the things that we're thinking about is that if we're going to settle somewhere outside of our Earth and other parts of our solar system, we're going to need to use the resources we find on that planet to be able to survive.
Okay.
So for example, on Mars, we're going to need to find the oxygen there. We can't bring it. It's just going to be too expensive. And so MIT scientists came up with this experiment, and it's a box. It's about the size of a small microwave oven. Some people call it like a toaster-sized box.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and so the experiment is called MOXIE. So MOXIE stands for the Mars Oxygen In-Situ Resource Utilization Experiment.
I like MOXIE better. All right,
like
MOXIE.
So MOXIE's job is to show can we actually extract oxygen or produce oxygen on the surface of Mars by actually using the gas that's already there, which is carbon dioxide.
That sounds backwards.
Yeah, it's kind of backwards. We take in oxygen and we breathe out the carbon dioxide. But on Mars, most of the gas in the atmosphere of Mars is carbon dioxide. Can we actually do the reverse? Can we take the carbon dioxide like trees do and turn it into oxygen using a machine instead of a tree?
Hmm.
And so the MOXIE actually was sent to Mars, and it was part of an experiment that was installed on the Mars Perseverance rover. So this is about, the size of a Mini Cooper. It's on the surface of Mars right now, and it's got all these experiments. It's searching for signs of life or signs of past life. It's a robot geologist, but they were able to tack on this extra experiment to see if we could actually extract oxygen from the carbon dioxide atmosphere.
And so
it's been on Mars for about a year and a half. It can't run continuously, so it has to run on and off because, Perseverance needs the battery power for all of its other stuff that it needs to do.
That's so crazy.
So how does it do it? So what the machine does is that it has to take the carbon dioxide atmosphere and it has to compress it using compressors, because the air and the atmosphere on Mars is so thin, it's actually about 100 times thinner than the atmosphere on Earth. So we're going to need to actually suck in a whole lot of this atmosphere, and then we have to compress it to the atmospheric pressures that would be found on Earth just for the machine to work. Then what we do is we take that carbon dioxide and we cook it to about 1,500 degrees. And when we get it to those kinds of temperatures, we can actually break an oxygen off of the carbon dioxide, and then we do a little bit of mixing, and then we can actually make oxygen 2 or O2 and carbon monoxide. Now, we don't need the carbon monoxide. That's a poison. Mm-hmm. But we use the oxygen O2 gas, and we can breathe it. And so,
wow.
Yeah, so cycling this machine, turning it on and off and on and off, over about a year and a half of being on Mars, we have produced enough oxygen on the surface of Mars to keep an astronaut alive for an hour and a half.
That's really impressive, though, because obviously this is only going to get, it's only going to get refined and better, much better.
Yes,
like that's
yes.
pretty dang good for the first time trying to figure this out.
For a little toaster-sized oxygen machine.
That's pretty impressive.
You're right.
That's got to take breaks and shut off. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's really amazing, actually.
Yeah, and it can't, 1,500 degrees, you don't want it to burn up the rest of the equipment on the rover as well, and that would make a lot of other scientists pretty
right. I mean, listen, an hour and a half. I mean, I say to my son all the time, whenever we go to the, to the playground, and he's like, "Mom, we're only here for 20 minutes. I'm like, that's 20 minutes more than if we didn't come at all. So an
that's
hour
right,
and a half
you know.
On Mars, it's pretty dang good.
That's true. That's pretty good.
Pretty dang good.
But we're going to need to make them bigger.
And yes, I would imagine so.
Yeah. And so we're going to need, about 4.5 to 6.5 pounds of oxygen per hour running nonstop for years in order for us to be able to have a chance to keep, 4 to 6 astronauts alive for the duration of the mission. So we're thinking about that. So our MOXIE 2.0 is already in the works, and this guy's going to be big. MOXIE 2.0 is about the size of a dishwasher. And we've got to figure out how to get it to Mars. But if we can get it to Mars and run this thing constantly, we want to see, okay, can we really get a machine to run that long, and how much oxygen could we produce? And then eventually we can scale it up even bigger, you know, probably about the size of a, you know, house or something like that, or a building, to be able to produce enough oxygen using this method on the surface of Mars. Yeah, so
that is very, very neat. I'm very impressed, and I can't wait to see how MOXIE evolves and
makes this possible. Eventually it's going to look, you know, it's going to be like the mechanical version of a tree.
That's so crazy. That's amazing. I wonder if they're going to like make it look like a tree at some point. Obviously, the aesthetics of it aren't important right now, but
that would be good, you know, because I mean, we're going to need something that kind of looks like a tree, just kind of remind us, you know, of where we came from.
You know? Yeah. Well, and you know, if we need like good ideas, we need something to, you know, we need the apples to fall from somewhere to hit us in the head, you know. So we need a tree. Yeah. We need a tree. We do. That's very, very cool, David. See, I tell you, there are things that you just can't find in the newspapers, folks, but you can find it here on WICC when you have science you may not know with David Mastery. Thanks, David.
That's why you listen.
That's why you listen, okay? Bar anything else, you learn the wackiest but really, really cool science stories from David here on the show. It's very neat every week. Thanks, David. I appreciate you.
You're welcome. Take care.
We'll check back in with David next week and see what he's got up his sleeve that time around. Let's go to traffic and weather on the sixes. I'm telling you, I feel like I think so hard during Science You May Not Know. And I'm also always so stunned and impressed. And I feel like I have the most exciting thing to talk about around the water cooler after my show is done. But I always confuse my colleagues. They're like, where did you come from? What's going on? Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from? Cotton Joe. All right. Now we're losing it.